yeah, thanks for having me here to discuss. As Tibor said, I'm a joint faculty member between York University and Perimeter Institute, and I just started. So I guess I have various motives for giving this talk. First of all, I think cosmology is a fantastically interesting field, and I'd love to share that with you. Second of all, I will probably be teaching explorations in cosmology in March, April, although that's not clear yet. And a lot of the topics I'll discuss sort of very briefly today we'll cover in great detail in that course. So if any of these things strike your interest, then you should definitely take the course. And third, you know, I'm very much in recruiting mode, so I know you all are probably thinking about what comes next in PhDs, and I would strongly encourage you to apply both at York University and here at PI. Okay, so this is cosmology at Perimeter Institute. Cosmology is an incredibly broad field. So I went on the website, and I just picked all the faces that I could find of people at York University and Perimeter Institute that I talk about cosmology with. And I had trouble fitting them all in one slide. And you can see the fantastically broad range of topics that these different people study. So, you know, everything from string theory-inspired cosmologies to quantum gravity, resolving singularities, numerical relativity, particle astrophysics, dark matter, eternal inflation, CMB. I mean, I had trouble actually fitting everything on one slide. So this is what I want to stress. Cosmology is a really broad field, and it draws on a huge variety of expertise. So you don't necessarily have to be a cosmologist to do cosmology either. You could be a string theorist or a particle theorist or, you know, be into numerical relativity, all sorts of stuff. So that's that, you know, if you see any of these faces around, now you know that they're interested in cosmology and you can talk with them about cosmology. So what is theoretical cosmology exactly? So here's my definition for you. So basically it's trying to understand what the fundamental laws of nature predict for the structure, contents, and evolution of the universe as a whole. And it's not really one theory, actually. It's a lot of theories, some of which you know and love already. So, you know, it could be something like understanding how the hydrogen atom works. That's very relevant for predicting what we see in CMB experiments because it depends on, you know, how the electrons and protons combine and form neutral hydrogen atoms, what exactly the properties of the CMB are. Statistical mechanics and thermodynamics, you know, string theory, the standard model of particle physics, beyond the standard model of particle physics, Einstein's gravity, dark matter. I could really just go on and on and on. And to be a cosmologist, you really have to have expertise in a wide variety of fields. And that's kind of cool because you get to interact with people that have expertise from a wide variety of fields. And it's really a lot of new stuff. You're always learning new stuff. For me anyways, that's my favorite part. So what is observational cosmology? Well, laboratory experiments certainly inform all of those theories that I listed on the other page. You know, we smash particles together. We look for tests of gravity by flying satellites or looking in the laboratory at small tabletop experiments. We look for properties of neutrinos, like the mass of neutrinos through their oscillation by looking at these experiments deep in mines. We look for dark matter, et cetera, et cetera. And this is all great. Now, the problem is that a lot of the theories that we know and love just simply cannot be tested by any practical experiment. For example, like string theory, right? If we really believe that the scale, the size at which string theory starts to become an important part of the description of nature is something like 10 to the 19 GeV, which is the Planck scale, well, good luck building any particle accelerator that's not the size of the entire solar system or galaxy that you could ever hope to achieve those energies. So it's just simply impossible. So the promise of cosmology is really to take physics like this and use the whole universe as a particle accelerator, as an experiment, because we know the universe began very small and very hot. So if I can go back far enough in time, then it becomes conceivable that I can test these ideas. Now, conversely, I can't build laboratory experiments that are huge. Right, so that means I can't test really small energies. But the universe is huge now. So conceivably, that means you can also test physics that operates at incredibly low energy scales. And so by doing cosmology, you get access to this huge, huge, huge variety of energy scales that you just otherwise wouldn't have been able to in a laboratory. Of course, there's a downside, because when you do observational cosmology, you're really trying to test these fundamental theories using a very limited and imperfect record of the past, which may be a little bit different than how you're used to thinking about doing science or doing physics, right? It looks more like this. So, you know, there's some plane crash. How did that happen? You get some black box and a bunch of debris and wreckage and all this crap, and then you have some theory about how planes fly, and you're supposed to piece together from that exactly what happened. Or, you know, here's this guy, he's dead. You know, like, how did he get there? What was the forensic, you know, evidence? You know, what can you piece together about the story that led to this guy being dead? Or you have some old novel and, you know, it describes interactions between two famous scientists and you want to figure out what their ideas were. You don't really know. You can't go back and talk to them. You just have to piece it together. So that's the downside of cosmology. You can't repeat the experiment of the whole evolution of the universe. You just get what you get. But the caveat is that this program has really been amazingly successful, I would say, like fantastically beyond anyone's wildest beliefs successful. So we have all this fantastic data, and I guess what I want to impress upon you is just, you know, these lines are various predictions for models of cosmology, models of the evolution of the universe, and these are data points, and here are the error bars, right? So we're now in an era really of precision cosmology where we can take these different ideas we have about how the universe might have evolved and test them incredibly precisely with data. Okay, so we're at the percent level of precision for testing these really fundamental theories of nature. So forensic science of cosmology is really a developed field, right? This is not fluff science. And because of the quality of this data, I mean, cosmology is really a data-driven field. So for example, like dark matter and dark energy, who ordered that, right? We wouldn't have thought to put these in our theories before we went out and actually found that they might have something to do with our universe. That was a data-driven discovery. And I think the most exciting part about modern cosmology is that this isn't the end, because there are a host of like great new data sets that are soon to be on our doorstep. You know, just to mention a few, like the Planck satellite, which measures the cosmic microwave background, which I'll talk about in a minute, is going to be releasing its data publicly and its first results in February. So hopefully there will be hints for new physics and better tests of old physics. There's new space telescopes to replace Hubble, the James Webb Space Telescope. There's ground-based CMB experiments. There are new galaxy surveys, all sorts of great data. And the precision is just exquisite. So this field is really coming into its own. This is a very highly developed field at the moment. And the promise of cosmology is that you can cycle through this loop of theory and data, and then hopefully in the end, after iterating enough times, you can learn something about the nature of quantum gravity, you know, dark matter, dark energy, particle physics, gravity, all these things, all of these theories that we can't necessarily get a handle on by doing laboratory experiments or particle accelerator experiments, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the promise. It's been partially delivered on, and of course the next generation will see if this is really a feasible thing to do, right? If it will continue. Okay, so that's sort of my brief summary of why I think cosmology is interesting and what it's about. So I don't know, any questions about sort of general things before we dive into the actual topic and the physics and ideas? Sure. So, you know, typically, well, you can think of a correspondence between energy scales and distance scales, right? So in order to probe smaller and smaller distance scales, I need to do things at higher and higher energies. So the universe began very small, and therefore it probed very high energies. Conversely, now the universe is very large, and so it probes very low energies. So when I say this, basically, I just mean the typical energy scales that go into different processes. So So the scale on which, you know, QCD becomes relevant, or the scale on which we can just talk about Newton's laws and we don't necessarily have to care about general relativity, or, you know, these types of things. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So just a show of hands, like before you came here, who thought they would be interested in doing cosmology for research out of curiosity? Okay. Sounds good. Who thought they would be doing a field I mentioned in the beginning that's related to cosmology, who might end up working on cosmology inadvertently? Mm-hmm. Okay, fantastic. All right, so if there are no other questions about generalities, then let's talk about ideas. Yeah? Okay. So what is the standard picture of cosmology that we work with today? Well, you can sum it up in a jingle from the TV show The Big Bang Theory. You know, our whole universe was in this hot, dense state, and then about 14 billion years ago, it started to expand. So here's a brief timeline of how we think that went. So in the beginning, there is a big question mark. We don't really know what happened. Then things seem to have cooled. So at about 10 to the minus 6 seconds, the universe cools sufficiently for protons and neutrons to form out of the sort of dense soup that existed in the primordial state. At about 1 second, atomic nuclei form. So at about 1 second, we start to get fairly good actual experimental information about what the universe was like. So you can do simulations of the rate of production of various elements. You know, things are fusing, things are hot enough in the early universe that they're fusing. So there's a prediction for how much hydrogen, helium, lithium, et cetera, that there should be around in the interstellar medium. We measure that, and therefore we get an idea of what the universe was like at the time atoms formed. Nuclei formed, excuse me. And then about 380,000 years after this fiducial Big Bang moment, neutral atoms form, so the universe is cool enough for electrons and protons to recombine. And then, you know, things progress much more slowly after this. So after about 100 million years, you get the first stars and galaxies. After about 9 billion years, you get our sun, and then here we are today, about 14 billion years later. So that would happen somewhere between the 10 to the minus 6 seconds and the question mark. But I will talk about that. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah?
My question is not directly related to this slide, but more generally, how do you look at the distinction between cosmology and the art? How do you know?
They're not really distinct. So general relativity is part of the theory of cosmology, for sure. So our models of the universe are solutions to Einstein's theory of general relativity, and that's very much a part of cosmology. So they're not really separate. Okay, so I'm going to take for most of this talk like a very egocentric viewpoint of this timeline, because that's more what I'm personally interested in know about. So, for example, this time at which neutral atoms formed. So it's the afternoon, let's watch a movie and veg out for a second. So here is a timeline of the universe after that 380,000 years. So the first image was an image of the cosmic microwave background, and then it's really boring for a while. You just basically have diffuse gas that clumps gravitationally until you form the first stars. That takes the universe, it reionizes it. Basically it makes it, clump, and then we get stars and galaxies and all this interesting structure, and eventually, this is going to show a picture of that timeline from the time of the CMB until today, and then, of course, we're sitting here and looking out at this cosmic timeline. Of course, looking farther out is like looking farther back into the past, because the speed of light is finite, so we're really getting a sampling of the entire cosmic history between the time the CMB was formed, that's when neutral atoms formed, and today. Okay, so let's talk about the cosmic microwave background radiation. So this is radiation that was released when the universe cooled sufficiently for neutral atoms to form. And it's the most basic prediction of the standard Big Bang cosmology. If things started out really hot and dense, eventually things were hot enough so that electrons just were not energetically allowed, really, to combine with protons. The temperature was above about 14 eV. So here's a little toy space-time diagram. So here's the early universe when it's hot and dense. These are the protons, those are the electrons, and they're all swimming around in this gas. And this is a plasma, so it's opaque, right? Photons interact very strongly with charged particles, so this is an opaque medium. And then all of a sudden, when recombination happens, the universe effectively becomes transparent instantaneously on cosmological timescales. You know, it takes a couple thousand years, but in cosmology, that's nothing. And from then on, this light is just free to travel. So when we see the CMB, we're seeing this part of the surface of last scattering. This is called the surface of last scattering, when light last scattered off of charged particles, basically. And that light just streams straight to us, and we get to see it today. So this was observed first in 1965, again, accidentally. So even this part of cosmology is really a data-driven field. So Penzias and Wilson were trying to do radio astronomy, and they found that there was this intrinsic fuzz everywhere on the sky. It was basically uniform, and this was the first observational confirmation of the Big Bang cosmology. So we kind of take this for granted. You know, we've read 50 books by Stephen Hawking and everyone else that, you know, the Big Bang is the theory of our universe, but this was really hotly contested until there was observational evidence, and this was the first observational evidence. It's pretty recent. So, as I said, they found that the CMB has the same intensity in every direction. And actually, when you think about it, that has a very drastic implication. I mean, this was the first evidence that the universe is really isotropic. It's the same in every direction, right? So that's a nice thing to know about the universe. That's a very basic property. And you can do this for yourself. So here's my colleague, Dr. Hirani Paris, with the low-tech instrument. It's just a television. So if you look at this TV, about 1% of the fuzz is in fact photons from the cosmic microwave background. So you don't need to be too advanced or sophisticated to do these experiments yourself. But you can do much better than a TV screen. You can fly satellites, which get above the atmosphere, get much, much, much better measurements of the CMB. And in the 90s, the first satellite went up, which was COBE. And it measured that the CMB is the universe's most perfect black body. So the spectrum of photons is really a black body, like to the umpteenth decimal point, it works. And you can very precisely measure the temperature. It's about 2.73 degrees Kelvin. You can also measure, for the first time with COBE, anisotropies in the temperature. So there are slight differences depending on where you look on the sky. It's just small, about one part in 100,000. Enter WMAP, which is about 2000, and this gave us the first precision measurements of the statistics of these fluctuations. So, you know, it can measure these fluctuations now down to about one part in a million or a little bit less. Okay. So it can get really good statistical data about the fluctuations in the CMB. And I'll talk in a little bit about what that means, but before I do that, here is the exciting part. The Planck satellite, which is currently done taking data, in fact, the data is now being analyzed, and they will release their first results in early 2013. And this is really, really, really exciting, because cosmology is a data-driven field, so who knows what they're going to find. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the intensity versus frequency, it follows the black body curve.
So the other characterization of the black body in terms of its radiation and emission, is it also because I don't know how to.
Yeah. So basically you had in the early universe thermal equilibrium. So you had this gas of photons and it was in very, you know, strong thermal equilibrium. And then once the universe became transparent, those photons just streamed, right? And the universe is like a big box. So now you have this big box full of photons that's basically expanding adiabatically. And so those photons, you started with the black body spectrum because they were in thermal equilibrium. And since they don't interact with anything, they never go out of thermal equilibrium. So it just expands with the expansion of the universe. So you get a black body, which, you know, at early times had very large temperatures, and then at later and later times, it shifts, the temperature shifts. So you'll recall that the position of the peak and the intensity versus frequency for a black body depends on the temperature. So with time, the curve just shifts, but it always maintains the black body shape. Don't make me remember the formula for black body radiation, because I can't think of it off the top of my head. Okay, so we've got all these fantastic experiments. So what can we learn from these measurements? So let's return to this picture of the hot early universe with all of these separate protons and electrons, which is opaque, becomes transparent, but there will be more atoms in one place than in another, right? The universe wasn't completely uniform, otherwise we'd never get galaxies and structure. There needs to be some seed to basically form structure onto, okay? So there are these variations in the density. So when these photons come to us, there are going to be slightly more or less photons in one direction than another, okay? So the intensity will be a little bit different, and will depend on frequency a little bit differently because it's a black body. So what you do is you go out and you basically fix the frequency and you measure the intensity in different directions. And these are these hot and cold spots that you see on these maps of the full sky. So this is a map of the full sky taken by WMAP. Don't be fooled by the dramatic contrast, right? These are fluctuations still of a size one, roughly one part in 100,000, so they're really small. So you get these hot and cold spots, those map directly onto the density field at the time the CMB was formed. And of course, from this, we get the standard model of cosmology, which we now have, which is that we live in a nearly flat accelerating universe composed entirely almost of dark matter and dark energy. So this is where a lot of the information that forms this sort of energy budget of the universe comes from these fluctuations, the statistics of these fluctuations. And I'll talk a little bit about how that works in a minute. So this standard model of cosmology is called Lambda CDM. Also has another name, the concordance cosmology, because when you combine the data from the cosmic microwave background with measurements of large-scale structure, so measurements of how galaxies cluster, and supernovae, basically how dim the standard candles supernovae are in different directions, you get this agreement here, okay? Which all of these, so these are error bars, if you will, just drawn in a two-dimensional plane. All of them overlap to give you a central value right here, which says that we live in a universe that's almost all dark energy, and you know, has some dark matter and lies on this line, which tells you that it's flat. So this is the concordance cosmology, Lambda CDM, standard model of cosmology. Works fantastically well. However, there's a problem. So this is basically just a theory of the contents of the universe, right? Once I know the contents now, I can project in the past how it evolved, and I can project in the future how it will evolve. But maybe I'd like to understand a little bit about how the initial conditions work. So how was this system set up in the first place? So we can learn something about that by, again, returning to this same picture. So here is the blue line is still the time the CMB was formed. And then here is the Big Bang, right? So time, according to the standard Big Bang cosmology, had a beginning. There was a singularity at some point, excuse me, where the density went to infinity. So if I look at, you know, sort of the parts of the Big Bang, well, maybe one thing to just clear up, right? The Big Bang is not a point, really. It's an extended surface. So in the standard model of cosmology, the Big Bang is not, in fact, a single point. It's a little bit bizarre. It's a surface of zero volume, but it's not a point. Yeah, deeper? Yes, yeah, I mean a three-dimensional surface. So. When we draw it this way, you can see that here's a light ray. It can travel here and affect this part of the CMB that we then see. But I can draw no light ray, because this is a space-time diagram and light rays travel on 45-degree lines. I can draw no light ray that will influence this other point over here. So different points on the sky, according to this theory, never touched. That's really bizarre, because according to this theory, according to the measurements, I should say, not according to the theory, who cares about the theory, all these different places on the sky are nearly at the same temperature, to within one part in 100,000. So if things never touched, how could they come into thermal equilibrium, and how could I get the world's most perfect black body, et cetera, et cetera? It's really bizarre. There had to be some conspiracy to set this up. And that conspiracy, we think, is this theory called inflation. So what is that? So inflation is accelerated expansion of the universe. So it can take a really tiny piece of the universe down here and turn it into what we were calling the Big Bang, which is this extended surface of very small volume. So what causes this behavior? What could possibly cause this accelerated expansion called inflation? Well, basically, we need something that dilutes very slowly or not at all as the universe expands, because as you'll learn when you take GR, that is a substance which acts like it has a negative pressure. Okay? Negative pressure causes things to expand. So if you were to draw this, it would look like, you know, the black color represents the density in this box. As the box expands, unlike a box of gas, the density just remains constant. It's pretty weird stuff when you think about it. And if I think about how the universe will evolve when it's filled with this stuff, so now let's just measure the size of this box, which we're taking to represent the universe, as some initial size, and then it gets scaled up by a factor A after some time. With a fluid that does not dilute, you get exponential growth of the size of the universe. And the scale that goes in here, the density that's required to perform this task, is truly astonishing. So you need something like 10 to the 85 kilograms per cubic meter of this stuff around. Okay. So this actually comes back to your question about energy scales and these things. Like, this is an extraordinary energy scale if you convert this density into an energy. And there's a candidate. So a perfect candidate is the potential energy of a scalar field. So you guys are taking quantum field theory right now, right? Have you talked about scalar fields? Yeah, okay, so you know what a scalar field is. It could be anything, right? There's no theory here, this is just a paradigm. It just says the scalar field will do this task for you. So a scalar field is something that takes a value at each point in space. So if I associate a potential energy with each point in space, then if I make more space, then those points that I make are just gonna also have a potential energy. So it's a stuff that doesn't dilute. Okay, that was the thing we required. Okay, so here's this picture, and you know, here's this stuff, and it will sort of do this task for us. So let's see if it will solve this problem of these two disparate points in the sky never touching. Well, again, this is a space-time diagram, so easy. Now, if I look back far in the past, certainly I can have a region here which influences both this part of the CMB I see in one direction and this part of the CMB that I see in another. So it's basically a way of taking the whole observable universe, everything we can see in the CMB, and making sure that it was in thermal equilibrium at some point in the past. It came from the same common origin, and that's the conspiracy. Yeah, so if we lived in a universe with no cosmological constant, that would be true. So I'll touch on that in a little bit. But well, the thing is, to form black holes, you need a contrast in energy density. So certainly, if you had over densities that were big enough in this background, then yeah, for sure you could form black holes. And you know, since it's such a large energy density, it might even be a very tiny inhomogeneity in terms of percentage of this total energy density, right? But the other nice thing about inflation is that it causes exponential expansion. So unless you have some object that is extraordinarily dense, it just gets blown apart because the whole universe is expanding. So inflation takes a rough, you know, the argument that you'll hear or perhaps have even read about before is that inflation takes really generic initial conditions, which could have been lumpy and all this, and it turns it into a big, smooth, and homogeneous universe. Because by expanding the universe exponentially, and when I say expanding, the total expansion that's required during inflation in volume is about e to the power 180. So the volume changes from 1 in some arbitrary unit to e to the 180. I can't write that number on the board. What's that, Tibor? On a time scale of roughly 10 to the minus 26 seconds. Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, crazy. That's why we're going to talk about how we test this idea in a few slides, because it's crazy. No, it's not actually. There are many arguments. So another argument is basically, why is the universe so exquisitely close to being flat? Right? If I started out with some arbitrary lumpy mess, right? So there's inhomogeneity, there's also spatial curvature, so like the geometry of the universe, if you will. And we measure it to be very close to spatially flat. But it could have been closed, like we lived on the surface of a sphere, or open, like we lived on a saddle, for example. And inflation naturally tells you why, because it takes this mess, whatever it was, and it blows it up. So the part that we see, you know, we're zoomed in on this tiny little part here. So you're never going to see any inhomogeneities, even if they exist, because they're just way bigger than the part of the universe that we can see. They got blown up that big. Another argument you can make is that, you know, if you believe in grand unified theories, or string theory even, I guess, typically you expect to produce some huge number of what are known as topological defects. They're called monopoles, so just like a magnetic monopole, say. And the density is typically large enough that it will cause the universe to collapse into a singularity before anything interesting happens. So you need some way of diluting these things. And inflation will do that for you too, because it just causes space to expand, so the number density will go down. It does a third thing, which I'll describe now. Or I guess that's a fourth thing, which is provide the seeds for structure. So during inflation, it's such a violent event. It takes things that are on incredibly small scales where quantum mechanics is important, and it blows them up to bigger than the size of the observable universe. And in fact, the postulate is that the quantum fluctuations in this inflationary field, the inflaton, are what seed the density perturbations, galaxies, everything that we see today. Okay. And that's quantitative. So you can explicitly predict, if you tell me what kind of field theory you have, what the spectrum of density fluctuations is and what the amplitude should be. And depending on the model, you find that there is very good agreement with what we see in the data. So it's not totally crazy. Although it's still pretty crazy to think that quantum fluctuations grow up into galaxies. So any questions on inflation? Yeah? Yeah. Yeah, so there is a conflict there. Part of the confusion is that it's really not 100% clear how to define entropy in a gravitational system. So that's one thing. But heuristically, we like to believe in the thermodynamic era of time. And that basically implies that the universe had to start in a very low entropy state. And there are other ways of understanding that as well. You know, for example, if I take the universe as we see it today and I evolve backwards in time and I just count every state that's compatible with what we see today, most of the time I'll get a lumpy, terrible mess. But somehow we're postulating that the only, you know, that the history of the universe went from homogeneous to not homogeneous, right? So that's an open question. It's a great question. No one really knows the answer. Certainly the type of thing that you know, me and other people in this building are very interested to discuss all the time. Depends on who you talk to. I think some people would say that it's a solved problem and it's understood, but other people would say it's an open question. The argument that's typically given, I guess there's a few variants of the argument that are typically given, but the large scale modes basically interact with the small scale modes and that causes them to decohere. Another thing you can show is that you get what are so-called squeezed states, which even though they're quantum states, for all intents and purposes, appear classical. But yeah, I mean, there are certainly a lot of open questions in that realm as well. Okay, I guess I forgot that last part. There's the CMB. So these quantum fluctuations are supposed to be imprinted in this spectrum of fluctuations up here. Okay, so how do you test it, right? So you take that map of the sky, and you take a prediction for the spectrum of fluctuations. So in inflation, you generically get a power spectrum. So this is measuring, you know, sort of the occupation number and different wave numbers in the universe. It's an amplitude times a power of k. That's the generic prediction. And you can go out and try and measure it. So here's what we get from, say, the WMAP experiment. I guess what I want to impress upon you is the size of the error bar. So you can measure this very precisely, right? And that's kind of incredible. You can get information about the energy scale of inflation. So it turns out that there is the quantum production of gravitational waves, and the amplitude of gravitational waves depends on the energy scale of inflation. So we can infer the energy scale of inflation from the non-observation of primordial gravitational waves. And that constraint is currently about 10 to the 16 GeV. So that's an interesting thing that we know about inflation. So a prediction of the most basic inflationary theory is that these fluctuations are Gaussian. So the probability distribution of hot and cold spots is a Gaussian distribution, effectively. However, that need not be the case. In fact, it's not the case in most models of inflation that are not the simplest model. So one sort of parameterization is to say that the actual fluctuations are the Gaussian fluctuations plus a constant times the square of a Gaussian, which is not a Gaussian. Gaussian plus Gaussian squared is not Gaussian. And you can go out and try and measure that. And so WMAP currently says that this parameter is you know, like 1.5 sigma-ish significant. So if it was zero, we'd have purely Gaussian fluctuations. But with Planck, those error bars are going to shrink by a factor of 5. So we're going to know, effectively, with Planck, if the simplest models of inflation still work or if they don't. Okay. So really, we're now is the time when we're starting to test these theories with a lot of precision. We can ask how much inflation was there, you know, so how much did the volume grow? Well, you can get that by looking at spatial curvature. So how flat is the universe? Is there any evidence that it's slightly not flat, which would tell us inflation couldn't have lasted longer than a certain amount of time? So here's the current constraints. Again, I want to just impress upon you the size of the error bars, which will shrink with time. So these Planck and SDSS3, SDSS3 is a galaxy survey, Planck is the CMB satellite, and you know, these error bars are going to continue to shrink. So for example, if this is really the value of the spatial curvature, we're going to know with 3-ish sigma when Planck comes out. So there are all these interesting things about inflation that we can learn from actual data. Okay. And that's really important. Okay, so let's talk about this other period of accelerated expansion, dark energy. So here's that timeline again, sort of turned on its head. So the universe started hot and dense. You know, this question mark is replaced by inflation. But then with regard to your question before inflation, there's another question mark because we don't know exactly how the universe started in such a low entropy state. But this is what we kind of know about the timeline of the universe, and here we are today. And today we're in this very unique time because the dark energy now makes up about 70% of the total energy budget of the universe, and that will just continue to increase as the universe expands because, remember, stuff that causes the universe to undergo accelerated expansion doesn't dilute, but everything else does. So it's just going to be a bigger and bigger fraction of the energy budget of the universe. Okay, so what happens? Well, the simplest explanation for what dark energy is a cosmological constant. It's just really a constant energy density at each point in space. So Einstein's biggest blunder is now our favorite theory of the universe. And if it really is a cosmological constant, then the universe will just expand forever. It will never end. Now, let's think about this. So let's contrast it with the energy scale of inflation. This comes back to your question in the beginning. What scales are we talking about? So if this is a cosmological constant, the energy density associated with it is about 10 to the minus 26 kilograms per cubic meter, which you can compare with 10 to the 85 kilograms per cubic meter, which is what we required to get inflation to happen. So really, we're probing an enormous range of energy scales, absurdly enormous. And the universe undergoes exponential expansion with this sort of doubling time. And if we look at the current age of the universe, we're now at a point where the universe would have expanded by a factor of E, roughly, due to dark energy. So a space-time with just a cosmological constant is called De Sitter space. And De Sitter space has here's the metric. I don't know how familiar you guys are with space-time metrics, but it basically just tells you the size of the ruler at different points in space, effectively. And just like in a black hole, De Sitter space has an event horizon, except for it's an inside-out black hole. So if I stray too far away from this classroom, well, if I stay in the neighborhood of this classroom, I can sort of fly around and come back to where I started. But if I stray too far, then I'm screwed. I can never get back. So the event horizon is an event horizon that I fall out of, not an event horizon that I fall into. So once you cross this boundary, which is basically the cosmological constant, I apologize, I should have changed that to lambda, which I used in the rest of this talk. So that h is just defined as lambda over 3, basically. In some bizarre units where m Planck equals 1 that I won't confuse you with now, but you'll learn about later. That's right. And just like for a black hole, signals redshift. So if you're sitting in this classroom and I'm speaking to you from out here, then you know my voice would begin to slow and you know things stretch. So there's the Doppler effect. So here's our future. We're sitting in this galaxy in the center, and we have all our friends, and the ones that are not gravitationally bound to us eventually will just expand with the accelerated expansion of the universe. They will pass outside of our cosmological horizon, and then they will be forever gone. So it's going to be a lonely future. It's also going to be a really boring future because here's the CMB. Well, those photons are just going to redshift because I'm probing distances further and further away. As time goes on, eventually I'll be probing distances of order the size of the cosmological horizon. And so that will just simply fade, right? And I won't have a CMB. So feel lucky, because if you were born maybe 10 or 20 billion years from now, there would be no such thing as cosmology. So this is another theory that we can test, and we can test it, again, with extraordinary precision. So again, here's this, I mentioned this briefly in the beginning, this is the energy density in dark energy, compared to everything else. It's about 70%, but again, I want you to just note the error bar, right? This is really quite tiny. We can also ask about the dark energy equation of state. So we can ask if it really dilutes, it doesn't dilute, or does it dilute just a little bit? Okay, so is the density changing in time? And again, this is something you can go out and measure. And just to note, the error bars are consistently shrinking. Okay. So if W is not equal to -1, the dark energy will dilute, and therefore it's not actually a cosmological constant, it's something else. And then we have to go back to the drawing board and ask what that something else is. So any other questions about dark energy or inflation? Or data? Yeah.
That matrix, is it has something to do with that Schwarzschild matrix? Since we have the that in geometry.
Yeah, so it looks very much like the Schwarzschild metric. That's right.
There is some difference, right? Since you have
So what's the difference? So the difference is so here's the Schwarzschild metric. And then plus the other part. That's not the important part to compare it with. And in De Sitter space, looks like that. So here, if I'm at large R and I go in towards 2m, then this thing goes to 0, that one goes to infinity, and that's what we call the event horizon, right? Whereas here, if I'm at R equals 0, everything's fine and dandy, but if I stray too far and I get to R equals 1 over lambda over 3, then this goes to 0, that goes to infinity, and again, I have an event horizon. So it's a similar looking metric, but they're actually quite different, right? Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so here's this picture again, and I guess I just want to impress upon you that there is really strong experimental evidence for at least two epochs of accelerated expansion in our universe. And this really has led us to ask some pretty fundamental and profound questions, just to sample, again, related to your question, how did the thermodynamic arrow of time arise? Is this a vacuum energy? If so, why is the density so small? You know, like 10 to the 26 kilograms per cubic meter, it's kind of a tiny number, where did that come from? Does the fundamental theory of our universe have a finite number of degrees of freedom or an infinite number? How big is the universe? Are there other universes? Are there other forces? What is dark energy? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so we could just go on. I mean, these experimental facts have spouted umpteen to the umpteen power papers, God only knows. Okay, so that's kind of an overview of cosmology, and I guess I'll just end by talking really briefly about my own research. So I'm interested in beginnings and endings, which you probably could have told from the beginning part of my talk. So things like the initial conditions for inflation and the future evolution of our universe. I'm interested in building fundamental theoretical models, say in string theory or something else, of inflation and dark energy. I'm interested in the role of extra-spatial dimensions, which are a prediction of string theory and cosmology. Identifying new imprints of fundamental physics on cosmology so we could have new things to look for in data. Analyzing CMB data and figuring out what the hell it means to live in De Sitter space, which no one knows. So that's just sort of a broad overview of the types of topics. And maybe I'll just spend 5 minutes talking about a specific thing. So the specific question is, how does accelerated expansion begin and how does it end? Is it easy enough? So it could begin and end nearly homogeneously in space. So that's kind of like inflation, right? The universe went from expanding to not expanding almost the same everywhere. So it looks basically uniform. It could just not end anywhere. That's like a cosmological constant. And the next most complicated thing you can imagine is that it begins homogeneously, but it ends locally in space. Okay, so pockets of non-inflation form out of a phase that is undergoing inflation. And of course, that's the interesting one to talk about. And this is an idea you're very used to. So, you know, if we boil a pot of water, liquid water goes to steam through the formation of bubbles that contain gas. These bubbles expand until the pressure inside equals the pressure outside. And that's how that goes. And just like that boiling pot of water, cosmological phase transitions of exactly the same type are allowed. And bizarrely enough, they can even happen at zero temperature. So how does that work? So again, we invoke scalar fields. If you study cosmology, you will become very intimately familiar with scalar fields because they basically do every single job you can possibly imagine in cosmology. Dark matter, dark energy, inflation, you name it. So what we require is two phases, okay? One of these phases is going to have a positive energy density, which will cause accelerated expansion. So if the universe is just sitting here with this value of the scalar field, it's going to undergo accelerated expansion forever. Boring. But quantum mechanics makes life interesting. So this is some potential barrier, and there's another phase. And just like, you know, a scanning tunneling electron microscope, you can have quantum tunneling. The wave function will sample that part of the space. And what that looks like in real space is the spontaneous formation of a bubble that contains this lower energy density phase. So we call this a false vacuum because it ends up decaying. And this is the true vacuum because that's the lowest energy state, the actual lowest energy state. So this doesn't happen everywhere. It just happens in these bubbles. And you can compute, using field theory, the probability, which if you take my course, I will show you how to compute. So if you're interested, stay tuned. And it's exponentially suppressed. So basically, it depends on the properties of this bubble. Just like any other bubble of something, it's got a surface tension. And there's some difference in energy density between the inside and the outside that causes it to expand. So this probability is just fixed by these things. And just one second. And because it's exponentially suppressed, it's usually really, really small. Yeah. Please?
But what causes them to collapse? Because you can only tunnel if you have collapse.
What's that?
You can only tunnel if you also have collapse at the end. Well, you will have spreading of the wave function.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to end up in the bottom, you have to collapse there.
So in field theory, you don't have a wave function, you have a wave functional. That's not really answering your question. But the sort of collapse of the wave function here is not really discussed. So think to your quantum mechanics course where you use the WKB approximation to find the tunneling amplitude between two sides of the barrier. You kind of assume you've got an ingoing plane wave that's, you know, classical in a sense as well, because the plane wave is a solution of the classical equations of motion. You've got your barrier, and then you've got an outgoing plane wave. Same thing here, except for it's in field theory. So you don't really discuss the collapse of the wave function, this and that. It's more like I connect this classical state in to this classical state out, and this gives you the amplitude to do that.
Uh-huh. If you have more than one bubble, uh-huh, is it inevitable that eventually they'll crash into each other and there'll be some?
Oh, fantastic. You're just, yeah, you're leading the talk. Next slide. Okay, so what happens when we have more than one bubble? So here's the universe. It's a box. And let's say the universe was not expanding. Okay, so it was static, or you know, maybe it was even expanding, but it was undergoing decelerated expansion. So it was expanding slower with time. So there's this pressure gradient. It causes the bubble to expand. Time goes on, there's a finite probability to make more bubbles, so they will form. And eventually, if I wait long enough, I completely erase that original phase. Okay, it's gone. So no matter how slow, no matter how small that probability is, if I wait long enough, then that original phase will just be gone. However, in an accelerating universe, the story is a bit different. So here's the universe at one time. You form this bubble. That bubble grows, but the universe also grows. You form another bubble. That bubble grows, but the universe also grows. And unless you form these bubbles fast enough, the phase transition won't complete. And that's something that's called eternal inflation. So you have this blue phase, which is causing accelerated expansion, the white phase has stopped expanding. But when the rate of forming these bubbles is lower than the rate of expansion, then accelerated expansion will just simply not end everywhere. Okay, so the phase transition never, ever completes. In this theory, the universe is infinitely big, which is pretty bizarre. If I wait longer and longer, I get more and more space, I make more and more bubbles, and it's pretty weird. It's interesting, but it's also well motivated. So before we talk about the motivation, let's just ask, okay, well, this is some bizarre theory, but how could it accommodate what we see today? We don't live in an eternally inflating universe. Inflation stopped. So the answer is that vacuum decay is in our past. So what we call the Big Bang was really the formation of a bubble where inflation stopped. And so this happens, you make some little hot pocket, which then turns into our observable universe. And this is something that's called open inflation. It's called open inflation because in this model you predict a universe that's spatially open. So here we are, we're in this little pocket, and there we go. So we're here, but there's other bubbles, right? So there are these other bubble universes that are predicted in this theory. So you know, if you go far enough away, there's some other, basically another universe. However, accelerated expansion prevents communication if these places are far enough apart from each other. So this idea, I would argue, very strongly is nearly inevitable in string theory. And that's basically because we take those extra dimensions that string theory predicts, which I'm sure you've read about, and we assume that they're really small, so we compactify them. But then I can imagine tons of different ways of making them small. And each of these different ways of making them small has implications for four-dimensional physics. It corresponds to a different phase. And furthermore, you can deform these configurations into one another at the cost of some energy. And so what you end up with is a potential landscape where the directions here correspond to, say, changing, you know, circle into weird three-hole shape. And so this is called the landscape of string theory, which you might have heard that buzzword somewhere. Basically, it's this potential landscape associated with deforming these different compact manifolds into one another. So you have all these phases. Well, we need positive energy because we think inflation happened, and we think we live in a universe with dark energy. So that means that you get eternal inflation, generically, because this rate of forming bubbles is exponentially suppressed. It's always really slow. And when you have it now, it's not just this you know, one type of pocket. Now you form a whole bunch of different kinds of pockets because I have a whole bunch of different kinds of phases. Okay, so you know, maybe you can argue that means that this is likely to happen in our past. Another thing you might be worried about is whether or not this could happen in our future. And I'll wrap it up real soon. So if you look at the standard model of particle physics, which you'll probably learn about in your field theory class, and you add a Higgs boson, which we now know is less than 130 GeV, if the recently discovered particle at the LHC is really the Higgs, and you assume there's nothing else but the standard model, then you will predict that we are a false vacuum and that our vacuum will decay eventually. That's a prediction of the standard model unless you add other stuff. But you know, don't panic because we've got a few years before our vacuum expires, probably like, you know, e to the some number billion years. It's not a big deal, but it will happen. Okay, so we get this picture of our universe where, you know, you've got all these pockets that are forming from expanding phase, and these pockets are expanding away from each other, et cetera, et cetera. You get all these pockets of all these different types. There's bubbles within bubbles. This just keeps going, and I made this movie too long, so it will just keep going. And you get this distribution of different sizes, different shapes, different types. And the idea is that out of this configuration, which interestingly is actually a fractal, so it's completely self-similar, inside of one of these pockets, you will find our observable universe. And that's the idea of eternal inflation. So there we are. And this is crazy. Surely I can't be serious, but it's really generic. Okay. So I would argue that you get this from, you know, having many phases, quantum field theory, and accelerated expansion. Those are the three ingredients you need for this totally crazy idea. There was a question?
Is there any kind of consequence of this eternal equation on the large scale structure
formula? You guys are great. I love it. You're just next slide. Totally leading all of my slides. Okay, so is it experimentally verifiable? And the answer is yes. So the way that you would see something is basically to look at the collision of our bubble with others. So even though you don't complete the phase transition, you still have overlap between different pockets. And that's going to have consequences for our universe. Basically, you predict that in the CMB, there will be these disks that have a very specific temperature profile, which you predict from theory. So there's some profile. It looks like this. You've got background fluctuations. Doesn't matter how that comes about. You know, here's an exaggerated example of what it would actually look like. So you'd have this disk-like feature in the CMB. And we have this exquisite data, so we can go out and look for it, right? Maybe there's not one, there's many. And you can see I made this talk way too long. But anyway, bottom line, a prediction of the theory is how many of these things do we expect to find on the CMB sky? And that's the thing that one can constrain with data. So we'll just fast forward to the end. From the CMB, you can predict a probability distribution that a theory that predicts n is consistent with the data. You maybe get something that looks like this. If it's peaked around zero, that means there's nothing there. The statistics don't favor that theory. If it's peaked somewhere else, that means you made a detection. And here's the data. So it's peaked around zero, right? So the current test of this theory basically says that at 68% confidence, I believe, which is right here, you have to have less than about 1.8 predicted things on the sky. And that's the current constraint. So we have this fundamental theory of nature, which seems to be a generic, you know, fundamental theory of the universe, which seems to be a generic prediction of string theory. And this is a test of said theory. So this is the kind of thing that I'm interested in doing. OK, so what's next? You could look for signals in the polarization. You need to somehow predict the signature very precisely. So another part of that is doing numerical relativity simulations of these colliding bubble universes. And I tried to make a movie for you, but it was not in the card, sorry. There's other links possibly between numerical relativity and observational cosmology that I'm interested in. These analysis methods can be used to look for other things, so topological defects, clusters of galaxies in CMB data, all sorts of great stuff. And there's plenty of other projects, so you know, involving model building, numerical simulations, data analysis, to answer questions related to these topics here. So if you're interested in any of these things and you want to talk about possible projects or just talk about these ideas, then here's my contact information, and I encourage you to come look for me. Thanks so much. It doesn't sound like it, so maybe that's about QCD, but I'm not exactly sure. So, yeah, I guess long story short, I don't know if that's related or not.
If string theory predicts a whole landscape of different vacua, do we happen to know for a fact whether or not it's bounded below?
In what sense?
Like whether it's the single lowest vacua.
That's a great question. No, we don't know. In fact, we don't really know much at all, I'd say. So there's a paradigm, which is just, you know, are there or are there not many different phases allowed? Any of the details are now just sort of anyone's guess, to be completely honest with you. But there are vacua, certainly, with negative cosmological constant, because those are the ones we understand the best, in fact. So the models of string theory, like I'm sure you've heard about the ADS-CFT correspondence. So anti-de Sitter space is space-time with a negative cosmological constant. And currently, one of the firmest predictions, or the firmest, you know, like understanding we have of string theory, comes from a correspondence between space-time with a negative cosmological constant and a field theory of one lower dimension. And that seems to be, you know, some very well-founded thing that comes out of string theory. So if that's true, then maybe there are negative cosmological constant vacua of arbitrarily, you know, arbitrary magnitude. I don't know.
It's time is the variable which makes the phase transition happen.
So the
like in some condensed matter system, temperature thing.
Right. So here the order parameter is the field itself. And as time goes on, you know, the phase transition spontaneously occurs, but it's a little bit different. In the sense that you know, here you just have an empty inflating space-time, and these things are happening quantum mechanically. Whereas in a condensed matter system, you know, typically you change some order parameter, and then the phase transition completes because it's, you know, energetically favorable to do so. It just happens classically. You don't need to invoke quantum mechanics or anything like that, or because of statistical fluctuations or thermodynamic fluctuations.
I would encourage you to go and talk to